Welcome once again to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And before we go on, let me say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guests, and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents. Anyway, today we have a literary agent, Marcy Posner. She's president of the Marcy Posner Literary Agency in New York City. Previously, she spent 12 years at the William Morris Agency as an agent and as vice president and director of foreign rights. Prior to becoming an agent, she was on the publishing side for 15 years, her last job as associate publisher at Pantheon. Prior to that, she was at Harmony Books and Rodale Press, among others. She also has a master's degree in library science and was once a children's librarian. She now has a small list of clients and plans to keep the agency at the boutique size. She represents both fiction, general, action, adventure, historical, mystery, romance, suspense, thriller, women's fiction, and nonfiction, biography, history, health, and lifestyle. Hi, Marcy.
Hi, Barbara.
I didn't realize you had such a background. Will you talk about how you found your way to where you are as an agent, going from your master's in library science to being publisher, associate publisher, to now being an agent?
Well, it's interesting because it really seems now to have been a natural progression, and I started out doing what, you know, people in my family did, which was either teaching or being a librarian, and found that I didn't actually like, I was a children's librarian and then I was a law librarian trying to find something I liked to do, and I found I didn't actually like lawyers in large groups or children in large groups. So I decided I needed to make a change and was about, in fact, to take a job as a management trainee for General Foods, when a friend of the family had just been named publisher of a small mass market paperback house, and he was looking for a secretary, and his wife knew I was looking for a job, and we got together on a Sunday afternoon, and he said to me, "When can you start?" And I said, "Tomorrow." And that was the start of my publishing career, and I went from this small mass market house. You have to excuse me, I'm just at the tail end of a cold here. From this mass market house to Harmony, which did more general kind of books, to Rodale, which was very specific at that time. It isn't as specific anymore. And then to a small publisher outside of Boston who mainly imported British books, and then on to Pantheon, which is part of Random House. And from there, I realized that I needed a change, and everyone I knew said to me, "You should be an agent. You shouldn't continue to be on the publishing side." So very luckily, William Morris hired me, and I stayed there for 12 years. And then when it seemed like the right time, I went out on my own.
Now, why would people advise you not to stay on the publishing side?
Because I think my personality is such that the limitations that you have as a publisher, the kind of corporate limitations, all of the things that have just, in fact, since I was in publishing, have gotten worse and worse over the years, were just not something I was very happy to deal with. And being an agent, also, you're the first and now, I think, the most important person that a writer deals with.
Hmm.
So I have much more kind of a hands-on relationship with my clients than I ever had on the publishing side.
Sure. So how has it changed? I mean, those of us who read writers' magazines and talk to agents and have books out probably know how it's changed, but fear more change. But those who don't yet have a book or what's different?
Well, part of what's different is the conglomeration. There are now really five places to sell books to of the big houses, and then you have a lot of smaller publishers and university presses and whatever, but it used to be all of these places like Harper and Collins and Morrow were all three different places. Now they're one place. And they're even more one place now after in the last couple of weeks than they were even last year. And they've closed down another imprint there. And so what's happening, and you can see it in almost any business these days with the May company, you know, with Federated buying the May company, is that there is just this consolidation of everything. And what's, and in that consolidation, there is less risk taking. There's less initiative. There's less, I think there are, you know, certainly some interesting things being published, but I don't think as many interesting things are being published by the bigger houses. I think you really do need to go to the smaller houses who are more willing to take risks.
Yeah.
So it's a very, the feel of the business is very different. And also with the chain stores, that feel is very different. There isn't the kind of hand selling there used to be, as much as hand selling as there used to be.
Sure. Now, when you submit something to a major house like Random House that has all kinds of imprints, how do you deal with the imprints? Can you submit to, you know, many imprints at once as long as they know what you're doing? Or do you just, you know, is there one at a time?
Excuse me. Every conglomerate has a different policy. So you have to know, which is why it's important to have an agent, because we know these things. You have to know what the difference is. Random House, you can submit to every imprint at Random House, and you do not need to tell them that you're submitting to other imprints. At the Penguin Group, you can submit to the different imprints, but you have to tell them. At HarperCollins, you really only submit to one. So it's every place is different.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm here today with Marcy Posner. She's a literary agent and president of Marcy Posner Literary Agency in New York City. And do forgive her. She has a cold and came on the show anyway. So, oh, poor thing. Talk about handling fiction and what you look for that comes in, what you're excited about that comes in the door.
Well, at the moment, fiction is probably the hardest thing to sell. It's the mass market business, which used to really drive fiction, is really has taken a real hit, and the numbers are just down astronomically. So that with fiction now, you have to look at something and say there are two things: either I just love it and I'm going to take it on, even though I'm not sure I can sell it, or I know this is saleable and I'm going to take it on. There's those two sides of the coin, because something that you like a lot, that you would have thought a couple of years ago you would have been able to sell, you will not be able to sell it anymore. So that everything is either genre or there's very specific. It's almost like the harlequinizing of publishing. So that what I look for is a voice that really that's just different enough, and where the writing is on a level that it reads like it's a third novel, not a first novel, and a third published novel, not a third just written novel.
Sure. So everybody I know is reading fiction, and you go into bookstores, you see people in the aisles. It seems as though people are still reading fiction, and perhaps more than ever, but apparently this isn't so, or at least the publishers don't think it's so, or something else is at play that is making it so that it's very, very hard to sell. What's going on?
Well, part of it is that there is so much being published that it's very hard to know, I think, for most people what to read,
sure,
which is why book clubs and reading groups have become so important in people's lives, because it gives them some way to figure out what to read. I mean, I know I'm in the business, and I walk into a Barnes & Noble or a Borders, and I'm overwhelmed, and I know what's being published. So I can imagine what it's like for somebody who doesn't know. We have no national reviewing medium to tell us, you know, to help us figure out what to read. So you walk in, and what happens is you walk in and you buy the brand name you know. And those books are selling 10 times more than they sold 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But then it's the new books, it's building writers, it's all of those kind of things that are just getting harder and harder to do. Now, it's going to be interesting. Everybody's experimenting a lot now to try to figure out how to sell more fiction and how to get people to take a chance on a new writer. Because when you have a mass market paperback is $8 or $9, that's not take a chance money.
Sure.
Anymore.
Right.
So really what's happening, I think, is people are reading what they know or what maybe somebody has recommended. But there are all those wonderful new writers out there that are not getting a chance because they're being, you know, they're priced out of the market in a way. So it would be lovely to find a way to, you know, have many Oprah book clubs.
Yeah. Well, in terms of getting the word out for books, fiction as well as nonfiction, you know, now we have the internet, we have blogs, we have online reviews that never see print. Of course, Publishers Weekly is still there, Kirkus is still there, Booklist, all the mediums that were there before. Is there any change in what is meaningful in terms of reviews, or is a PWS starred review still worth its weight in gold?
I am not sure that PW starred review is worth its weight in gold anymore. I think, you know, a Today Show book club pick is worth more than a PW starred review.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that, you know, what Oprah showed us is that if you have one person who says, I love this book, and you read it and you love it, you will then trust their judgment again.
Yeah.
When you have, you know, even the online reviews, often with a lot of these websites, it's different people reviewing books. So you never know whether your taste is the same as that person's taste
mm-hmm.
until you get to know the reviewers. And I think that's the problem. With movie reviews, we know the movie reviewers.
Yeah.
But with books, it's different. If you look at the New York Times book review, it's not the same people reviewing the books every week.
Mm-hmm. Hmm.
So I think that's really, you know, it certainly has helped, but I think that online reviews have helped more with genre fiction, you know, with romance or, you know, mysteries where there's, you know, that kind of specific following.
Yeah.
Than for general fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Which is a lot harder.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers on Writing, and I'm talking with Marcy Posner, who is a literary agent in New York City. In terms of fiction that you see selling, you said, you know, typically genre fiction sells most. And are you talking about romance? Are you talking about mysteries? Are you talking about, you know, where it's very clear what this is and where it goes on what shelf?
I think that's really what happens. And then there's chick lit, which has, you know, taken over the front tables in most of the bookstores with all of those pink covers.
Mm-hmm.
Because, again, that you see that pink cover, you know what you're getting.
Hmm.
And so I think that in the same way with a romance novel, you kind of know what you're getting. Mysteries, you also do, but the mystery market is not as good as the romance market or the chick lit market. The women's fiction market is, you know, much broader and so more difficult to, you know, define and figure out how to reach as easily.
Sure. So if somebody's making contact with you for fiction, is the query letter and a few pages still pretty much standard, or is there some other means?
No, I think that's really pretty standard. What I like specifically is just an email query letter. And then I'll ask probably to see a longer synopsis and the first couple of chapters by regular mail, not by email.
Mm-hmm.
Because then I spend way too much time in front of the computer.
Sure.
So I like to get the longer parts by regular mail.
Mm-hmm.
But the query letter is still very important. It is what catches my eye. If you tell me what the story is and you've written that letter well and the story is interesting, I will want to see it. But the writing in the query letter is as important as the writing in the book.
Even though it's probably a different style.
Right. Even though it's probably a different style, absolutely. In fact, you don't want, if you're writing a literary novel, you don't want a literary query letter. You want a query letter that is going to tell the agent about the book and what it's about, but it needs to make sense. It needs to really be able to synthesize the story, and, you know, it needs to be just well written for what it is.
And when you're looking at, say, a query letter from a would-be novelist, a hopeful novelist, are you looking at their experience in terms of, you know, whether they have short stories published, whether they have essays published, articles, what their sort of background is? Or are you going basically on the writing and just taking it with that?
For me, I go most on the writing. I mean, I also, you know, there are all kinds, every writer's conference has a contest, and most of those, for me, are completely meaningless. Having judged many of these contests, often I know that I've picked my first pick is the lesser of five evils.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily good. It's just the best of the bad.
Interesting.
So for me, winning a contest doesn't mean anything.
Mm-hmm.
It really, and again, because fiction is so subjective, it's really reading the material and saying, I love this or I don't.
Right. So you wouldn't necessarily read a novel or read a couple of chapters from a manuscript and say, well, it's not really my taste, but I can see that it might be commercial, and so maybe I'll take it on.
You know, I used to do that, and I found that I don't want to do that anymore because if I don't love something and I don't really believe in it, I'm not the best person to sell it.
Yeah.
And especially in this market, you have to really, really believe in what you're representing.
Mm-hmm.
I don't do that.
Is it the same for nonfiction?
Nonfiction is not the same.
Uh-huh.
Unless it's like narrative nonfiction, in which case, yes, you have to love the writing and you have to, you know, you certainly have to be interested in the subject. But with nonfiction, it's really, that's where if I think the subject is something that publishers will be interested in, if the person who is writing it has a platform, then I'll take it on, even if it might not be, you know, exactly what I'm interested in.
Hmm. Talk about that a little bit more, platform, because certainly those who are writing nonfiction have been hearing about this more and more, how important platform is.
Well, it's, you know, there is so much going on out there. Books have to compete with every other, you know, form of entertainment to get attention, that to sell a book in nonfiction, fiction, forget, but to sell a nonfiction book in a certain subject area, that person has to not only be an expert in their field or a journalist who is, you know, writing about this, but there has to be a way to get publicity for the book. There has to be a way to sell copies of that book to a targeted market. So that, let's say, it's a business book. The person who's writing it needs to have some kind of national presence or a really strong regional presence. They need to do seminars. They need to do things where they can sell books in the back of the room. Those are the kind of things, because publishers don't have the money to go out there and figure out a way to sell books. You, the author, needs to come with that platform already in place. I have a writer who's a woman who has her own financial company, and she speaks at seminars about women in finance, but she only does it in New York. That's not enough.
Hmm.
So I've hooked her up with a lecture person who handles people like that all over the country, with people who are just starting out. And so they're going to start building her platform, and then I'll be able to sell her book.
Interesting. But again, this mostly has to do with nonfiction.
Right, nonfiction.
Yeah.
Fiction, a platform, you know, unless there's like some great hook that you can get off the book page publicity, that's great. But that's not, a publisher will not buy a book because of that. A publisher will buy a book because they love the writing.
Mm-hmm.
Or it fits, or that kind of writing fits into their program.
Mm-hmm.
No matter what your platform is in fiction, it comes down to the book.
Yeah.
In nonfiction, it comes down to the platform.
Hmm. Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Marcy Posner. She's a literary agent in New York. And one more question before we take a break. In terms of the book remaining on the shelf, now, it seems that with fiction, publishers are very interested in this, in a novel becoming very, hopefully well-read really fast, whereas with nonfiction, there seems to be more longevity, especially if it's a trade paperback, that it doesn't go off the shelf. It doesn't get remaindered in 2 months. Will you talk about that and sort of, you know, whether that is indeed true?
That's absolutely true, Barbara. The nonfiction, especially in trade paperback, that's the life of the book. That book, if in that subject area, if that book has gotten good reviews, people say this is a really good book in this subject area, that can stay on the shelf until it becomes obsolete.
Mm-hmm.
But with fiction, if the book hasn't built a following, especially these days, if it hasn't, you know, been picked up by book clubs or whatever, it's going to have a fairly short shelf life because there are so many other books waiting to come and take its place. And unless a bookstore and a publisher can be sure of selling copies month after month, they can't afford to keep that book on the shelf.
Now, does that hold for trade fiction as well as hardcover?
I think it actually does. Mm-hmm. I think it's because, in fact, more and more books are now being published in trade paperback originally, novels, because they feel like that's a better price point to maybe get people to take a chance on an author.
Yeah.
So that now you'll see a lot of publishers doing original trade paperbacks, which it used to be that you did it in hardcover and then it rolled over into trade paperback, but
mm-hmm.
that's not necessarily the case anymore. So again, there are still a lot of books waiting for that shelf space.
Yeah. Interesting. I want to talk more about this. We're going to take a really short break, so all of you out there, stay with us. Marcy, soothe your throat for a few minutes.
I will. I'll drink some more tea. Thank you.
So we don't torture you, and we'll be right back. Don't go anywhere. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we have been here since 5 o'clock with Marcy Posner, a literary agent and president of the Marcy Posner Literary Agency in New York City. Hi, Marcy.
Hi, Barbara.
In terms of what we were just talking about, hardcover fiction, trade paperback, who and what determines whether a book will be hardcover or paperback?
The publisher is the one who determines it, and they buy the book based on what they see its market being. So that, and also the agent knows there are houses, let's say like NAL, who only do either mass market or trade paperback fiction. They don't do hardcovers. So you know when you send a book to them that the format that most likely they'll do it in is trade paperback. So often it's the agent controls it to an extent by knowing who they're going to, what kind of books, what format that person publishes their books in. But then once a house buys a book, they really determine what format they're going to do it in.
Interesting. Are there a ton of meetings and just, you know, really marketing that goes into these decisions?
There's just, you talk to people and they're, all they do is go to meetings. It's just one marketing meeting after another. There are usually, there are three seasons in publishing now, which when I first started in publishing, there were only two. And so that there are launch meetings and marketing meetings and pre-launch meetings, and it's just one meeting after another to try to figure out a way to sell these books that these people care about. It's just that there are so many books and so few ways to get them noticed.
Why are there so many books being published? I mean, you know, if the market is glutted with too many books, making it harder for, you know, quality fiction and nonfiction to get out there, why?
Well, but then who makes the decision which books not to publish? And
yeah.
No publisher wants to lose market share. They don't want to miss out on publishing some great book. So then they just keep publishing, and then they keep publishing more. And then all of a sudden one day they look and go, oh, my God, we're publishing too many books, and they cut back their list. And then a couple of years later they look again and say, whoops, it just creeped back up again.
Hmm.
And that's what happens.
How many books, do you know how many books were published in 04?
I don't know, but I have always heard a number like 45,000 trade books a year.
Right, so that's not textbook.
No.
It's not ebook. Book. It's, yeah.
Right, that's hardcover, trade paperback, mass market. That's, you know, that's a lot of books.
That's a lot of books. With my students, I'm always encouraging them to be patient and take their time, which is not something that writers want to hear. They want to finish their manuscript. They want to get it out there and get it in book form. What worries me about that is that little thing, that little evil thing called the Nielsen book scan, which it seems can, if you don't sell books, if your first book gets out there and it doesn't sell, and you go to sell your second book, my understanding is that publishers will look up the sales of your book through BookScan, which is only available, I guess, to publishers.
Right.
And if it didn't do well, then your chances are really kind of cut down.
They're slim to none. It's much easier to sell a first book than it is to sell a second book. There, and because they've also, especially if the first, you know, obviously if the first book, even if the first book did okay but didn't do brilliantly, the second book, especially if you didn't have a two-book deal, the second book is going to be a hard sell because it's much easier for the publisher to go out there with a new writer and say, oh my God, this is our new, whatever, the next whomever, and get attention for it in that way, at least get the booksellers to pay attention,
sure.
As opposed to somebody whose first book was maybe well-reviewed but sold 5,000 copies in hardcover. The bookstores look and see how many they sold, so they say, oh, I'll take one, you know, and so the publisher would much rather have a new writer.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not a great position to be in.
Do you see
so
a lot
that
of...
what where we started with this was to tell people to take their time. And most writers who come to me and, you know, send me their manuscript and I say it needs some work, and I say, take your time. Really fix it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't think that getting it to me quickly is what I want.
Right.
Because that's not what I want. I want it to be right. I want it to be the best possible book it can be. Because when we go out there, even before it goes into the bookstore, when we go out to try and sell it to a publisher, we don't get a second chance.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah. But what about, you know, it used to be the publishers nurtured writers' careers. Are there, and now we hear that just doesn't happen, but are there any publishers that do see taking on a writer as sort of a long-term, perhaps lifetime commitment?
I think everybody would like to think that's the way they see things. You know, nobody goes into this, nobody I know, I mean, these people are all really care about what they're doing. I don't think they go into it thinking, I don't want to keep this person forever. But they're also in a business, and if that product is not selling, they need to move on. I think, again, the smaller presses, and certainly, you know, places like Farrar Straus and, you know, some of the more literary houses will nurture people a little bit more than some of the other places. But, you know, I've seen some of the big commercial houses take somebody and say, well, we're going to stick with you through another couple of books and see what happens.
So is the onus then on the author to just, you know, hire a publicist and just really, really market the heck out of their book?
I think that's what they really need to do. Now, for fiction, to hire a publicist, you know, internet publicity is a good thing to do, and to do as much as you can on your own. Fiction, again, is very hard to publicize. On the web, it's a lot easier to publicize because there are so many websites. And I have one client who I just consider, you know, the queen of doing her own publicity. She is amazing. And she gets the book reviewed early, so then she can do her own press material, so then she can send them out to everybody with a couple of early reviews. I mean, she is just on top of everything, knowing exactly what needs to be done to get that book noticed. And she's a romance writer, and she ended up in the top 100 romance books for, you know, the last couple of months.
Hmm.
Doing this on her own because her publisher did nothing.
Yeah. Yeah, you hear more and more of authors needing to really spend some of that advance money and get things going early instead of waiting until the book comes out.
Oh, you have to do it before. Because the book has, again, what we were talking about before, it doesn't have a very long shelf life. So that if you're not getting things going so that everything hits just when the book lands on the shelves, the book is going to be off the shelves before any publicity is hit.
Mm-hmm.
So you really have to, I mean, any, like, you would hire, if you're going to hire a freelance publicist, and there are certainly some who can get some attention for fiction, you need to do it 3, 4, 5 months in advance.
Hmm. Well, what about if a book, you know, well, a couple of things here. If your first book or second book didn't sell well and you're feeling a little nervous, is it advisable to change your name? And, or even the first time out, just going out with a pen name so that at some point you can revert back to your own name if necessary.
I think more and more writers are doing that. And I in fact, have advised a couple of people to do that. Because now when you can, everything can be checked online, you know, how well a book did can be checked by everybody. You just, and that's what a publisher as well as a bookseller bases their purchases on. There's got to be another way for you to get another book out there. And the best way to do it is to make up a new name.
Hmm. So you have no objection to this?
No, I have no objection to it at all.
Interesting.
Yeah. I'm sure there are people who do, but I think especially in the more commercial fiction,
yeah,
in genre fiction, there's, and also, you know, there's, excuse me, there's, you can also do that because, let's say you're writing, you know, romance is an easy category to talk about because you can be writing contemporary romance and historical romance. Maybe you use two different names for those two different things because they really do have different markets.
Sure.
So that, you know, it's not a bad thing to do.
Right. I mean, I hear of more and more people who do that, or even, you know, there's a literary agent in New York who writes, a man who writes romance and writes Nancy Drew, and you know, unless you knew this guy, you would never,
right,
you know, it wouldn't occur to you.
Yeah.
And
no, and there's no reason not to.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very, you know, for that kind of writing, that kind of commercial writing. And then let's say one of these areas that you do really takes off, then you can, that's what you concentrate on, and that's, then you can do, let's say, publicity where you get known.
Mm-hmm. So what would you do then, though? You'd have to go out under your pseudonym.
Well, you can go out under your pseudonym, but look, like Perry O'Shaughnessy,
mm-hmm,
it's two women. Everybody, kind of, a lot of people know it's two sisters, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So it, you know, at a certain point, it doesn't matter.
Right. Yeah, because your readers, they're not caring about the name.
They're really not. They're caring about the writing. And,
sure,
and it's kind of interesting to know it's two sisters,
mm-hmm,
writing. And, you know, just that, I think, has helped.
Yeah.
In fact, so.
Interesting.
And look at, you know, James Patterson, who writes with, you know, anybody.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's funny. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I have some time here left with Marcy Posner and no end to the questions. So let us not dawdle. I'll ask you another something that we're kind of going into, which is crossover. So in terms of readership now, do you see much crossover in terms of journalists going into fiction or fiction writers going into journalism and that being a problem? Is that sort of
I don't think it's a problem. I think you see more journalists going into fiction than fiction writers going into journalism.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you look at Jim Lehrer, who has written now, I think, 16 or 17 novels, all of which have done well. Not great, but well. And so I think you see, you know, more of that.
What does well mean?
Well means probably, you know, hardcover under 50,000 copies.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Certainly, you know, a double, not a
sure
home run, you know.
And then what about say literary writers wanting to try something else, or say a mystery writer might want to try a literary novel, and would they would change their name probably?
I think they would have to change their name because,
sure,
you would have, unless they were a famous mystery writer, and then you don't have to worry about it. But mm-hmm. for anybody who isn't famous, you really have to change your name because the bookstore is going to look and say, "I'm what is this?"
Sure.
And also because everything's so categorized now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, so you have to really, you have to say, I mean, you, there are, you know, romance writers who then break out of romance and start writing women's fiction, and they still get shelved in romance, even mm-hmm. though a romance reader would not like this book.
Right.
So it's very tough once you're categorized. So often it is better to change your name unless you have, you know, a really big following, in which case then you just have to take your chances.
Mm-hmm. So we talked about fiction coming in, that you like a query letter to begin with, an e-query. What about nonfiction? Nonfiction
book. I still would like an e-query, and then I'll ask to see the proposal and a sample chapter, which is what you need to send to a publisher. And in the query letter, it's really important to talk about what your platform is.
Mm-hmm.
Because if there's no platform, there's really no point in wasting both of our time.
Sure.
On the other hand, I represent a book that just came out that, where there was no platform. It's called To Love, Honor, and Betray, The Secret Life of Suburban Wives. And it's a nonfiction book written by a journalist. And she interviewed 26 women who have either had affairs, are having an affair, or want to have an affair. And they're all, you know, it's Mrs. A, Mrs. B, Mrs. C, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But she wrote this as a journalist's book. And the topic was interesting enough that you could get past the no platform.
Mm-hmm.
And her platform obviously became Desperate Housewives.
Right.
Also.
Right.
I mean, the timing was just brilliant. Not that we knew this was going to happen. Because
mm-hmm.
I sold the book before Desperate Housewives was on television.
Hmm. Yeah, perfect timing.
Yeah, but that's the one way you can get around platforms sometimes, is if it's a journalist.
Hmm.
Writing about a subject that they know about, and that subject is of interest to the publisher and then to the public.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. What about small presses or even self-publishing?
I'm so not a fan of self-publishing.
So somebody has published with a print-on-demand publisher.
To me, that's not publishing. That's
right.
Printing.
Yes.
Okay. Anybody can print a book, you know.
Right.
That is not publishing. Publishing is where someone has made a judgment that this book is good enough to be printed and then sold to the public.
Mm-hmm.
Self-publishing, you know, print on demand, nobody has done that except for you,
right.
The writer.
Right.
And so to me, you know, when I get queries and somebody says this book's been published by something that I know is not a publisher, I won't even look at it. Unless somebody says to me, I self-published it and I sold 5,000 copies.
Yes.
That's a completely different story.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to sell that kind of number to get anybody's attention.
Mm. Well, what about small presses then?
Small presses, I think, are becoming much more interesting because they are more willing to take risks. They are more willing to take on writers who, you know, have... you know, are writing risky, interesting books. And there is somebody there saying this book is worth it. I mean, you look at the guys who ran McMurray and Beck, who now have a company called Unbridled Books, and they published The Girl in Hyacinth Blue.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of their first books. And they just did an amazing job, and it was an amazing book. But no major publisher wanted to publish that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that it's a place to look at. And I do send things to them. I send things to McAdam Cage out now in San Francisco and into a number of small presses.
Mm-hmm.
And a small press, though, is different than, let's say, a regional publisher.
Right.
You know, so it's really got to be a small press who really see themselves as publishers, not as publishing just books that are of interest to a specific area.
Sure. What's your take on what's happening with independent bookstores?
You know, it's really interesting because I just had this conversation with an editor the other day, because this book, To Love, Honor, and Betray, was not in two of the bookstores in the area where the author lives. And the author was very upset, and I was talking to the editor about it, and she said, you know, how much information can you send these stores and tell them about a book? If they don't order it, you can't force them to order a book. There are some great independents, but there are a lot of small independents where people have decided they like books, so they're going to own a bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be a business. It has to be run like a business. And that's why the chains have been able to take over so much, because the independents were not, you know, many of them weren't run like businesses. Some of the best, like the Tattered Cover or the bookstall in Winnetka, and a lot of, you know, the really, really good independents do an amazing job.
Mm-hmm.
And hand sell books and can make books. In the same way, a lot of the mystery bookstores have made the careers of Dennis Lehane and Robert Crace and Harlan Coben. All of those guys really built a following through the people who run the mystery bookstores all over the country.
Hmm. Mystery bookstores really do seem to be, at the forefront of really promoting authors.
Yeah, they really are.
There's all kinds of events.
They're amazing.
Yeah.
They really are. They really, because they know who their market is. It's so, you know, there are fanatics all over the country. You know, and my husband is one of them. Well, basically, he reads mysteries and thrillers, and that's all he reads.
Uh-huh.
And so he just goes into that mystery bookstore every 2 weeks and buys, you know, a couple more books.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And they know who their market is.
Yeah. Do you find clients at conferences?
You know, it's interesting. I have actually amazingly found a couple of clients at conferences, and I'm always stunned by it because I generally really go to the conference to meet the younger editors,
mm-hmm.
who go, not to find clients. But I did, actually, the Texas Writers League, I've been to a couple of times. I have two clients I found there, and both of whose books I sold. And I found one at Pike's Peak, and I'm in the process of selling that now. So
mm-hmm.
I'm just kind of always surprised when I do.
Hmm.
Because I think for most of us, for most agents, we're there because it's in an area, maybe we have some clients and the clients come and we see them. Or it's a great way to really meet the younger editors. It's mostly young editors who come to the conferences,
mm-hmm.
and they're the ones who are hungry and looking for new material.
Because I know writers always wonder, you know, if I go to a writers' conference, which one should I go to? Should I go to one where there's mostly, you know, workshopping going on of manuscripts? Should I go to one where there's a lot of literary agents? Because there's so many anymore to choose from.
But I think it's where you are in the writing process,
mm-hmm.
and that's what should really decide you. If your manuscript's done, you really doesn't need any more work, go to one where there are a lot of agents.
Mm-hmm.
Because you never know. You might find somebody who likes what you've done. If you still need to hone your craft, going to a conference that has workshops is a great idea, because it can help.
Yes.
And, you know, a lot of these... A lot of the conferences have really grown into really good teaching places. And I think there are some great some great classes. And one of the things I found that whether you go to the agent panels at these things or go to these it really, you learn how to do all of this right, whether
mm-hmm.
it's how to do a query letter, when to send things, all of those kind of the nitty-gritty of things of being a writer. You can learn those at the conferences so that it makes the path to finding an agent a lot easier.
Yeah.
So that, you know, we always talk about at the agent panels, talk about don't just do a wholesale mailing to every agent and say, dear agent.
Do you get letters like that?
Oh, I get them all the time. And the really scary thing is there's this new thing called Script Blaster
uh-huh.
that somehow I got on their list. And I get queries from people constantly, obviously not addressed to me. You know, it's an email.
Right.
And so it's my, you know, it's my address, but it, then it's just a description of the book. And I'm thinking to myself, what, how do you, I delete it immediately.
That's amazing. I mean, it's sad that, that writers, that somebody is, you know, telling writers this is going to help you.
I know. And the really scary thing I have to say, and I won't say who did this, but I got one from someone who happens to be run a writer's conference.
Huh.
And that she didn't know that this was not an appropriate thing to do was very creepy.
Oh, my goodness.
So, I mean, do you know, the key thing is to do your research.
Yes.
And go online. There's something about all of us on the web, and figure out who is the best person for you, who does the kind of, who represents the kind of writing that you like, that you think your book is like, and query people like that. Don't query somebody who does science fiction and you write, you know, literary fiction.
Hmm. Well,
you'd be surprised.
You have been most interesting, and I wonder if you want to give out contact information.
Sure. I mean, you can email me at marcy@marcyposner.com, and it's MarcyPosner.
Okay. Marcy@marcyposner.com. Thank you so much.
It was my pleasure.
It's been great, and I hope you feel better.
Thank you very much, Barbara.
You're welcome. That was Marcy Posner, a literary agent and president of the Marcy Posner Literary Agency in New York City. And as she said, you can find her, email her at marcy@marcyposner.com. What else? We have a minute or two left. If you want to know more about the show, who's coming on next, you can go to my website at penonfire.com. You can email me from there if you want to be on my weekly email list. I'll be happy to shoot you out an email every Wednesday or Thursday morning to tell you who's coming on the show. I don't share the list with anyone, and you can't see who all I'm sending it to, so you're not, your email isn't going out to a million people. Events are on my website at penonfire.com. Marcy talked about conferences in April, tax week, right after you file your taxes that day. There's a conference in New York City, the ASJA conference, where I will be, and a ton of magazine editors will be there, literary agents. It's a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Go to ASJA.org, or you can go to my website again, penonfire.com, click on appearances, and I have links to places I'll be, and that's one of them. Bharati Mukherjee was supposed to come on today. She was in traffic. She knew she would be in traffic in Berkeley going to an event. So she'll be on in another month or so. What else? I'm going to leave you with a quote, and then we're going to check out of here and make way for James's Between the Lines. But let's see. What's a good quote for tonight? Tonight is let's see, we had on an agent, and, well, you know what? I'm going to read you this quote, because often writers talk too much about what they're working on, and I use this quote in my book, Pen on Fire, and it's by Doris Grumbach, who said, "Talk uses up ideas. Once I have spoken them aloud, they are lost to me, dissipated into the noisy air like smoke. Only if I bury them, like bulbs, in the rich soil of silence, do they grow." It is so true. So very true. Thanks for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week.